We're talking about President Trump's efforts to overturn the election, throw out ballots that have been cast, and push dubious claims of voter fraud, and how these overtures disenfranchise voters, especially within communities of color. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in the sixth day of a recount in Milwaukee and Dane counties, not the rest of the state, mind you, which is largely white. Civil rights advocates, political scientists, historians echo the sentiment that this is a brazen attack on black voters. Milwaukee voters, what challenges have you faced in elections this year? Do you feel heard? How do you feel about the Trump campaign challenges? It's 800-642-1234. Angela Lang is executive director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities, or BLOC. Angela, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Christine Newman-Ortiz, Executive Director of Voces de la Frontera Action, an immigrant and labor rights advocacy organization. Christine, welcome back.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
Well, Christine, let's start with you. Before we go back into the weeks leading up to the election, what are your takeaways right now as you watch these legal battles unfold and the challenges to the vote?
It's not unexpected, actually. I think it's consistent. It's consistent with Trump and how he has operated. You know, he's operated in really promoting lies and undermining democracy, attacking civil rights of people of color, and others, and so I think it's and he's really, you know, tried to promote belligerence and violence from a base, a particular base that follows him uncritically, and that's why he was voted out of office, frankly. And he is you know, they are now transitioning out, and thank goodness that there are still people, you know, that even in, like, you know, in different parts of society that have stepped forward, whether through administrative or, you know, especially like the election commissioners, like who were Republican, and just that, you know, our imperfect system was, you know, has operated to really make sure that the votes have been counted. And if there is disenfranchisement, we know it comes certainly here in Wisconsin from photo ID, from gerrymandering. So if you want to talk about voter and disenfranchisement, there is. But despite that, the harm that has been done and what he has kind of woken up, tried to wake up in people, there was a huge, you know, response or rejection of that, especially from people of color voters. So I am hopeful. And I know the people who we organized, and I know Angela and her folks, you know, like we're hopeful for the change that's overdue, that we are going to fight for under a new Biden administration.
Angela, with the recount underway in Dane and Milwaukee counties, requested, paid for by the Trump campaign, what effect do you see this having on our state's two most diverse counties and the voters there?
Yeah, you know, I've said this whole time that some of the most marginalized folks that are the most hard hit from voter suppression are also the same ones that are hard hit from the pandemic. And I feel like this is just a distraction for our state. Our COVID cases keep rising. They keep climbing. Our families are suffering. And instead of, you know, lawmakers being able to focus on this, you have folks like Robin Voss that are also saying that we should be investigating these issues, which is completely ridiculous. And it
Assembly
takes
Speaker.
Away what we can actually be doing in our state. And also it further, as Christine, I think, alluded to, it further divides this kind of us versus them mentality and us, you know, being black and brown people that are the most marginalized. We see that his supporters, they believe every conspiracy theory, they believe every lie, and some of them are actually moved to action and be dangerous in our own communities. And I think that that is also something that is at risk of knowing, as long as these conspiracy theories and these just like ridiculous accusations keep flying around, it can actually be very dangerous for our community. We've seen what happened in Kenosha when the 17-year-old, whose name I refuse to say, opened fire on three protesters and killed two of them, right? We're seeing how this outgoing president has stoked those fears and being able to say that Black and brown people and Indigenous folks can't even vote the right way without it being suspected as something illegal is also a long-term damaging effect to communities of color.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Angela Lang there, Executive Director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities, or BLOC. Christine Newman-Ortiz is Executive Director of Voces de la Frontera Action. We're discussing the election through the lens of race and what we see now in these legal battles and the challenges of the vote. Your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Christine, now take us back in the weeks leading up to the election. What did your work look like?
We were really building momentum much earlier on because we knew how high stakes this election is for the Latino community and for so many others. So we really started a new approach in 2018 that was very successful, called Voceros por el Voto, and it was really focused on building a statewide voting network, primarily of Latino and youth to turn out. And so it's also known as kind of like relational voting. And so we did that, and it was very successful in 2018. And then for 2020, really, for over a year and a half in the lead up to November 3rd, we just really scaled that up, even through the pandemic, which was possible to do because it's based on people you know. And we're able to get to over 20,000 voters, primarily Latino voters in that network, Latino and youth. And then we were able to also kind of do what you would do traditionally, which is like, you know, through like work Spanish language media as statewide. We did phone banking. And then towards the end, we did COVID-19 safe neighborhood canvassing because it was just, you know, because that you just had to be able to reach some people some way through traditional means. And so we ended up, you know, reaching 100,000 people, the majority of those which are new or don't vote frequently.
Angela, how about you? Because the situation was growing more dire with COVID, not being able to meet and organize in person, and police brutality and the protests through the summer and into the fall, the Black Lives Matter movement. How did all of that factor into the work that you were doing?
Yeah, it was just really difficult. I think a lot of organizations had to pivot very quickly. We are the most known for our field program. We had a really ambitious goal of being able to knock 500,000 doors with all four elections this year. And we had to shut down our office in mid-March, actually, just a few weeks before the April 7th election. You know, we had to switch to tools like Hustle and virtual phone banks in order to text. But those were things that we didn't even have as an organization because we're just so used to being out in the field. So we had to convert those conversations in a more virtual space. But then we also wanted folks to know that we were there for them, you know, not being able just to text them about the election or making sure they know how to request an absentee ballot. There are times we were doing wellness checks on folks. It was a couple days before the April election and we weren't leading with the election. We wanted to make sure that people were safe. They had whatever they needed and being able to be connected to resources. And we also know that every issue that that this related to in our community was also something that we were dealing with personally. So increased mental health challenges, increased domestic violence issues, all of those things, our ambassadors who were showing up every day also had to deal with. So it was incredibly difficult.
Let's pause there with the leaders of Black Leaders Organizing Communities, Angela Lang and Voces de la Frontera Action, Christine Newman-Ortiz, back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the effects of President Trump's challenges on communities of color and takeaways from voter turnout and organizing. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Detroit, a group of voters brought a federal lawsuit Friday claiming the Trump campaign's legal actions aimed at throwing out some disenfranchised black voters. How do you view these acts of trying to throw out votes in cities that overwhelmingly vote Democratic? Is this an attack on black voters or, as the president's lawyers say, an effort to have safe, secure, and fair elections? It's 800-642-1234. Angela Lang is head of BLOC, Black Leaders Organizing Communities. And Christine Newman-Ortiz leads Voces de la Frontera Action, and they stay with us. Christine, the American Election Eve poll says the 2020 Wisconsin Latino turnout was 74%. How does that high percentage strike you?
This is a historic level of turnout, and traditionally it would be at a little over 50% or less than 50%. Voces has been organizing, you know, since 2004, the Latino vote. But, you know, it's historic in terms of, you know, not just the turnout, but the also the sheer size. So, and that's true for like Wisconsin, but it's also true nationally. And so it's without a doubt, it was decisive contribution in the results, in delivering this victory for the Biden administration. And so, you know, to me, when I think about it, it is there's a saying that, you know, the Latino vote is the sleeping giant. And it was this election where the sleeping giant woke up and stood up, and it was the election in which to do it. So there's a tremendous amount of pride. I do feel it interesting because in the initial narrative of the elections, one of the things that we've had to fight consistently, you know, has been kind of a dominant narrative that really does have a blind spot or actually falsely represents, you know, the importance of the Latino vote and also like the issues that drive them to vote. So
that you can't make these sweeping generalizations about how a group will vote in any one way, that, you know, there is a lot of diversity within a particular demographic group.
Correct. And so in the initial narrative that came out through the like Edison poll was like, why are Latinos, you know, why are there so many inroads for Trump and so forth, that narrative, which was absolutely contrary to reality. So there was definitely been like some unpackaging and immediate challenging to that. And what was really exposed is that like the Edison poll, not just this year, last year and others, it really like oversamples Cuban voters. So example, in Florida, Cuban voters are, you know, have been, you know, traditionally very conservative. Also, it doesn't take into sample Spanish language voters. It doesn't go into major cities, you know, where you have a majority, actually, of Latino voters. So those initial numbers were skewed. And so what I have seen unfold over the years is there's been a real ownership, too, around Latino engagement in elections, including like the polling, which is much more nuanced, mm-hmm. which really breaks down the community. So here in Wisconsin, the majority is from U.S. you know, of Mexican American descent. Then you have, you know, naturalized immigrants, largely from, you know, largest being from Latin America and from Mexico within that, and then followed by Puerto Rican, and then from Central America, South America. You know, Caribbean, kind of as a third group of Latinos.
We're talking,
and they have different experiences.
Yeah, we're talking with Christine Newman-Ortiz and Angela Lang, their community organizers in Milwaukee. We're discussing our diverse politics and what we learned in November. With your thoughts as well, did you work to organize your family, your friends, your neighbors? What did you learn from that experience? 800-642-1234. Angela, I'm wondering if this inability to see a group for who they are transcends Black voters, transcends Hispanic or Indigenous voters, that these groups do not get the level of analysis and nuance that they deserve, and therefore you see these sweeping generalizations about, quote unquote, the Black vote.
Yeah, absolutely. I think every cycle, people always want to get a handle on the Black vote. Or if you're in Wisconsin, the code is like, oh, well, we have to figure out Milwaukee. And I think a lot of times people just don't know how to interact with our communities, which I think, you know, the work that Christina and I do is so important because we are so deeply connected into the communities in which we advocate and serve. And I think in 2016, we saw that, you know, Black and brown voters were taken for granted. There were assumptions made that we voted for Obama, so we didn't need a certain level of persuasion, maybe that other demographics did. And so I think people learned that lesson in 2016. And ahead of the 2020 election, we know that, you know, presidential candidates, when it was a crowded primary, were they were coming to our city early. I know we had three presidential candidates visit us in 2019. So people definitely learned to pay attention to the Black vote and the Latino vote. But at the same time, I felt like people this year kind of became obsessed with it in a way of just polling and data and numbers. And everyone wanted to have the most Black support. But what did that actually mean? Did that mean that they knew our stories? Did that mean that they knew our issues? Were they writing campaign plans based off of the feedback in the community? So I would like to see a little bit more of that. You know, I'm glad that there's more of a dominant narrative about the role of communities of color and voters of color. But I would like to see that teased out a little bit more on what that actually means, instead of folks just feeling like they've earned our support but don't really have anything more else to say about that.
Yeah, so it's like, will they show up to govern? Will they show up understanding and carrying out the constituent issues and needs?
Absolutely. Right. And that's something that we need to make sure that we're doing on a year round basis. That's why it's so important for our organizations to continue to exist and not just pack up and go home, is that we are able to do that accountability work, especially on the local level. We're able to talk to older people and then make sure that they're voting the ways that we want to see them vote. And when it comes to the city budget, for example. And so it's so important for us to make sure that after we elect folks, we don't just kind of walk away. If we actually voted for change, we need to see that change through. And I think a lot of times we go really, really hard and get really, really excited to elect people. And then we walk away expecting them to know how to govern, when really the people that elected them should be helping guide the agenda of what they should be doing.
Like, that's when the real work begins. Christine, you know, what do you see there? How would you like to see both parties respond to your constituents when it is time to get down to work and to carry out these issues and these needs that they've heard on the campaign trail?
I think at the federal level, the Biden administration has a really good platform on immigration and on the pandemic response. And those were two issues that really drove people to the polls. When we talked to people, it wasn't just an anti-Trump vote. They really wanted to know, needed to know, Black and Latinos have been, families have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19. And, you know, they have higher numbers of, you know, essential workers. Those were, you know, big issues that we knew we were also during the pandemic early on relating to supporting people in getting the protections they needed, issues around access to testing and all that. And so, you know, that agenda is very good. I think it includes appointments, too. Like, who are you appointing to the administration? Are there people who are going to truly champion those issues and continuing to engage the community? And I think, so fulfilling your promises and making sure that you, particularly to people of color voters, because it is too often that when people turn out to you, and frankly, I'll say, you know, whether it's people of color or labor, they're taken for granted. And I would just say, we're not going to take ourselves for granted. Mm. And so it is about making sure that we are, pushing for that. And there is an urgency. It's not just, these are not small things, the issues around, so much harm in the case of the immigration, the new appointment. It is someone who was involved in the implementation of DACA that protected, dreamers.
But and I was going to ask you, Christine, how does the lack of representation of undocumented immigrants affect their participation and trust in politics, in the political process?
It starts from a place of alienation. And frankly, for a lot of working class Latino U.S. citizens, too, there is a real disconnect, which is what, we've been working on for a long, long time. And so what we saw with this approach, which is really organizing through people you know, and again, outside of elections, this is what we do, but it was only till 2016 challenged the traditional way things were done that we could kind of take that same approach into an electoral organizing. And it's so empowering, so transformative. What we saw was, for example, Luis, who's a DACA recipient, he's actually the pastor of the Hispanic Ministries, the Methodist Church statewide. And his parents were deported. He ended up organizing 50 voters he knows to turn out.
Wow. Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you both for joining us. Christine Newman-Ortiz, Executive Director of Voces de la Frontera Action, Angela Lang with Block. We're talking about what it's like to teach in person in the pandemic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's largest teachers union wants the Department of Health Services to set criteria for when schools across the state should switch to virtual learning. Currently, local school boards make that call, local districts. The Lake Mills Area School District in southeastern Wisconsin is in person. Teachers filed nearly 24 complaints over health and safety on the job. Teachers, what delivery mode are you in? What do you need to keep your classroom safe? What have you seen at your school amid rising case counts? Do you have enough substitutes, by the way? It's 800-642-1234. Brenda Morris is an English teacher and school librarian at Lake Mills High School, serving nearly 500 students. She's one of 22 teachers who recently filed safety grievances with the district. Brenda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you've been part of your district for 22 years now. What is it like teaching students in person?
It's both wonderful and terrifying. My job is all about my students. I always say that they're the best part of my job. And so I do appreciate the chance to be with them in person right now because I do think that's our best mode of learning. But it's also sort of terrifying because as we see the case rates go up out in the community and, it's just very concerning to think about the fact that our school is not separate from our community. And as those case rates go up, I'm concerned about the safety of my students and my coworkers.
How is your room set up? Give us a layout, if you will, and how many students you have.
Well, as I'm mostly in the library, I just teach one class right now. Most of my coworkers are teaching three classes. And I was in a classroom that was actually too small for me to safely distance the 14 students that were in my class. And so I've moved into our computer lab that's a lot bigger. So it's one student per table. They're all 6 feet away from each other. Everyone's wearing masks. We don't share supplies. The students use computers quite a bit, and so then there's the whole process of now be sure that you clean the computer before you put it back on the computer cart, so there's a number of safety procedures in place. I go around and sanitize the room after the students leave. It's really different from what we're used to.
What about ventilation?
We're in a building that's been upgraded quite a bit recently, and I'm actually in a brand new wing, teaching a brand new wing, which is it's beautiful, and I'm so thankful for that. And our district says that our ventilation is above the state standards for what we need to, keep the air turned over in a safe way.
So since the district chose to prioritize in person over the summer months, what safety precautions were put in place, and did you feel like those were adequate at the time, or has that changed?
It's been interesting. Like I said, the students are required to wear masks. We are doing extra cleaning between classes. There have been some hiccups with that. So, you know, part of our concerns were about times when the mask rule is not being fully enforced and sometimes when the sanitation isn't consistent. But overall, I think it's been pretty good in terms of following the safety standards. We've worked hard. Most of our classes, I think, are at a point where we can distance pretty well. But in the high school, I know that, you know, class sizes vary depending on, you know, the sections and what the student schedule is and all that. And so there have been some classes that that are a bit crowded and, frankly, aren't really able to distance correctly. And I feel
when
like,
you say crowded, what numbers might you be talking about?
Up to 20, 22.
Yeah, yeah. How?
And I think we've done pretty well in our district. I just, I'm not sure that everybody can do it this well, and we already feel concerned. So I'm also concerned about people in other schools that are still in person and whether they are getting this consistency of safety precautions.
Have you had any cases, or how have those been handled? Have you had teachers out?
We've had teachers out. At one point, we shifted to virtual at the end of October and into the beginning of November. We did shift the district to virtual for 2 weeks because there were enough, I think, not just teachers, but also custodians and support staff that were either positive or in quarantine, so that the staffing was just impossible. And so we did shift to virtual at that point. There's been some cases among students. You know, as far as I know, it hasn't been anything really serious. I guess I'm concerned about, you know, so far it hasn't been anything serious, and I worry about where we go from here.
How do you handle lunch with the students?
In the high school, the students are eating in the cafeteria distanced, and
okay.
We do only have about half of our high school students in person because students were given a virtual option.
Okay.
And so about half the high school students are doing either a blended or a virtual option. We have open campus at lunch, for juniors and seniors, you know, so that keeps it, but I'm going to be honest. I don't go out into the lunchroom.
Sure.
And so I couldn't tell you firsthand what it's like there.
Are teachers expected to then be able to teach both in person and virtual, deliver the curriculum in both ways?
Yes, yes. And that has also been one of the challenges that we do. We have our in-person population. We also have our virtual population. And it's not always easy to, you know, do everything seamlessly for both without some extra effort. Our school district has approved half days for students on Fridays so that the teachers have some more time to connect with the virtual students or prepare lessons or, you know, whatever we need to do. But it's been a struggle for people. I think we're getting better at it, but, you know, it's not exactly the kind of thing we all trained for.
It seems like it would also increase greatly your workload trying to deliver the curriculum, deliver those lessons both to your in-person learners and your virtual learners.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It has increased people's workloads. And my coworkers are spending longer hours than they ever have before on this kind of thing. With just one class, even, you know, for me, it takes more time, and I'm spending more time trying to figure out how do I get this content to the virtual students. This quarter, I've been trying a thing where I have my virtual students join a Google Meet at the same time as my in-person students, and it's been a really interesting technical challenge, you know. And so there, too, it's like there's this huge learning curve for us trying to flex and meet the needs of students in different locations.
We're talking with Brenda Morris, high school English teacher from Lake Mills Area School District, librarian there. We're offering in-person and blended learning. We're learning what that is like for a teacher. Brenda and some fellow teachers are pushing for further safety precautions and to transition to virtual learning. Are you a teacher? What is your setup like? What would you like to add? 800-642-1234. Brenda, I would imagine that you stay close to the library as librarian. What about those books? How do you even begin to keep those areas clean?
Well, this is another part of this year that's been so challenging. I feel terrible, but the library has been closed for browsing, so we're not actually allowing students to just come in and, you know, and browse books and check them out. However, we have an online catalog, so I've done a lot of outreach with study halls and the English teachers to show the kids how to use the online catalog, and they can place holds on the books they want, and then we deliver them either to their homeroom or for the virtual students, we set them in the front lobby where materials are regularly set out for virtual students to pick up.
Okay, so the stacks, they can't browse, but they can still get books from the library. They can still do checkouts.
Yeah, they do online browsing, which, you know, isn't the same. There's not that, maybe that serendipity of this book looks cool.
Right.
But, you know, but we're doing the best we can to keep them safe.
Well, I want to move on to the safety grievance with your district. You, along with 20 other educators, disputing how the district is handling the pandemic. What are you saying through this grievance?
The most important thing we're asking for is the clear gating criteria that would signal, you know, the required shift to virtual learning. There were a couple of measures that were put forward at the beginning of the year about what would shift a building or our whole district to virtual learning, and those seem to have gone by the wayside as we've gone on. And so what we're really asking for is that safety be put at the forefront of those decisions. And at this point, it looks to us like staffing has been the most important consideration. And so we're just looking for some clarity. You know, our district does have a pandemic plan. It lists some categories of information that the district is looking at when making the decision about shifting to virtual or staying in person, but it doesn't have any actual, like, numbers, like, this is where this becomes a concern.
Oh, so you're looking for clear, measurable gating criteria to make these, you know, to inform these really difficult decisions as to whether we should stay in person or whether we should do a blend or go fully online.
Exactly. I mean, it's hard to make any good decision at this point. Every decision we make has its risks, it has its drawbacks, it has its difficulties and challenges for our families, our students, our staff. But we're just looking for clarity. You know, the pandemic plan says that the district is looking at, for example, active number of COVID-19 cases in the county and the community. So what we'd like to see are some numbers attached to that that say this is, you know, I don't know, maybe like the green, yellow, red ratings that you see on some of the CDC guidance where this becomes a level of concern and this becomes a higher level of concern.
How would you characterize the communication right now between teachers and the in-classroom needs and the administration and the district?
There's definitely a lot of communication going on. And our administration has been very willing to meet with us and talk with us. But I think we're just not finding that common ground where we can agree that these decision-making processes could be made more clear.
Brenda Morris is teaching at Lake Mills High School, has for decades. Do you work in a district where teachers are advocating a switch to virtual? What are you doing to make that happen? Do you feel heard by administrators? And if you teach in person, are your students able to social distance? Do you feel comfortable in your setup for the winter months ahead? Still time to talk about this, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brenda Morris here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with English teacher and school librarian Brenda Morris. She's one of 22 teachers who recently filed safety grievances in the Lake Mills Area School District over the deteriorating conditions of COVID spread and safety concerns in the classroom. Brenda, the state's largest teachers union, the Wisconsin Education Association, is advocating for statewide gating criteria that would dictate to all, you know, schools in the state when they would switch to a virtual format. What do you see in that? Do you support it?
I do support that. I think that having those statewide criteria would really help bring some clarity and like predictability and hopefully a bigger focus on science and public health to the decision-making process. What I worry about across the state is that the decisions are being made maybe more politically or based on someone's convenience, and I'm just worried that safety and public health are not at the forefront.
How have your grievances in the group of teachers who brought them, how have they been received? How have administrators responded?
Well, we started by asking that the board consider the grievances immediately. You know, there's a five-step process where we're supposed to start with our building administrators and then work to the superintendent and then to the board. And because these are district-level decisions, we thought really the board should consider this. And they asked us to follow the process. I think their rationale was to ensure that everything was being done within the buildings that could possibly be done to, you know, to make us feel like that we're proceeding safely. But we are continuing to appeal kind of up the line just because we really do want these standards to be set at the district level that would make it clear how we shift to virtual.
Now, your district has a dashboard for COVID. What do you see through that dashboard?
Well, that's a good question. When I look at that dashboard, I see, you know, the numbers of cases and the numbers of quarantines within our district. But those numbers seem to disconnect us from the community. And I do think that what's going on in the community is affecting our schools. And so I just, I want to make sure that we're making decisions that take that into account.
If the district would go back to a virtual format in these times, is that enough here for you and your colleagues to feel safe and to feel heard?
Well, like I said, it's not just about the shift to virtual. It really is about setting those clear criteria. I do wonder, like, the cases are increasing, the hospitals are filling up. You know, it's all over the news that we should be more concerned and people should be taking more precautions. And so I also wonder, like, if not now, when would be the right time to shift to virtual? Are we at that crisis point yet? It seems like maybe we are. And I also wonder what else are we doing in the community? You know, restaurants and bars are open, or, you know, are people still mingling at parties and things? Like, maybe we also need the community-wide response.
What are your students saying? How do your students feel?
I'm going to admit I've been a little afraid to ask some of them because the situation's been so politicized. I do know that some students, you know, earlier in the first quarter, I had a student who specifically said to me, "Hey, I'm going to shift to virtual. My mother and I don't feel like it's safe to be in person anymore." You know, and so that student volunteered that information. I know some students have said that they're concerned that they won't do as well at home because they know that they are not as disciplined at home, you know, and there too, like, we agree as teachers, we know that this in-person model is the best academically for our students. It's the best way for us to connect with our students. I just would hate to see any of our students or staff become one of those statistics.
Yeah. Brenda Morris with us, English teacher, school librarian at Lake Mills High School. We're asking what it's like to be an in-person teacher in these times with your thoughts on this as well at 800-642-1234. Brenda, when you did switch to the virtual format, did your district have enough resources so the students had the computers, had the connection? Have there been issues there?
I think we've been able to help most of our students out on that front. We've got devices that we can loan out. In fact, we even have gotten some new ones in the district recently. We have some hotspots we can loan out. And I know that doesn't make everything perfectly easy for all students, but I think we've been able to help most students have the access they need for virtual learning.
Are there broadband issues, connectivity issues?
Definitely. I mean, I know some of our students live in rural areas where it can be a little bit harder to get connected. I have seen in other districts where there's some limited possibilities if the school shifts to virtual for some students to still come in person, you know, small numbers of students to get extra help. So I don't know if we would, you know, if that's a model to follow where there's some flexibility for someone to come in and use the internet in our building or something.
So in these times of in-person classes, in-person learning, has your school provided you with adequate PPE, personal protective equipment?
They did provide us with some masks and face shields. I think for the most part, people have supplied their own. For me personally, I have a friend who's a really good seamstress who makes the most comfortable mask ever, you know, and so for me it was a matter of kind of my own comfort and just wanting to supply the mask that I felt right in. You know, so the district has provided some of that, and they've also handed out masks to students. We do have enough cleaning supplies, you know, so like I said, I think in our district within the buildings that we are doing what we can to mitigate the risk. I worry a lot about maybe some districts elsewhere in the state that don't have these resources, and I worry about whether this is even enough in the face of the increasing case rates in the community.
What is the timeline here? Because COVID isn't stopping, and you're having to go through like a five-step process to try to get some answers.
Mm-hmm. Well, at each step, when the grievance is submitted, the administrator needs to respond within 10 working days, and then after we've met with that administrator, they have another 10 working days to give, you know, kind of a written response. And yeah, so it just, this could be weeks before we see any resolution. And clearly, just because we complain does not guarantee that we get what we're asking for either. So it's, there's some uncertainty there about how this would all work out.
As we wrap up here, what would you like to tell your fellow teachers out there? What can you say?
I just hope that we can all stay safe, our students and communities, as well as we teachers. And I want them to know that they're not alone in their concerns, and that I'm really happy that our state union is also speaking up for us to try to help us get the safety procedures that we need.
Brenda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brenda Morris is an English teacher and school librarian at the Lake Mills High School. She's secretary of the Lake Mills Education Association and Wisconsin Education Association Council Region 6. We reached out to District Administrator Tanya Olson, who provided us with this statement. It says, "The Lake Mills Area School District's primary responsibility, in addition to educating our students, is to keep our students and staff safe. We have been working closely with the Jefferson County Health Department, and we monitor what is occurring in our community daily. We have worked tirelessly, and as a result, we have contributed to controlling the spread of COVID in our schools. Additionally, we take our staff's concerns very seriously and have addressed their concerns as they have come to us. We will act in the best interest of everyone in our school system, continue to follow the COVID response plan that we have in place, and we will respond to changing circumstances as warranted. I wish to thank our staff, families, and students for their hard work during this difficult time. We remain dedicated to educating all the children in the Lake Mills community, and we are taking all necessary actions to ensure the safest environment we can." End quote. Just ahead, author Denise Kiernan is with us exploring the concept of gratitude in her new book, We Gather Together. Is it possible to be thankful in these trying times? Do you feel gratitude? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.